The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Here's round one, and for 2 marks, I want to know the meaning of the following words. Dillis Powell to start with. Dillis, what's the meaning of skiamachy? S-C-I-A-M-A-C-H-Y, skiamachy or skiamachy.
It could be a K, could it? S-K, or couldn't it?
It could be a K, easily.
Well, I work that out. It's a battle, and skir is a shade or shadow, so it's fighting the shadows.
Absolutely right. 2 marks it is. It's an imaginary or futile combat, a sham fight for exercise or practice, and 2 words, as Dillis quite rightly says, one meaning shade or shadow, and the other meaning fighting. Dennis Norden, what is a mavis? M-A-V-I-S.
Who just stand back a moment. I have heard the mavis singing his love song to the morn. That may remind some of you that your car needs tuning as well. Mavis is a bird.
Yes.
It's a singing bird.
A very singing bird. Yes, well, have a shot. It is almost the most common singing bird.
Thrush.
Yes, fair enough. Good. 2 marks.
If they bum you, they're called a missile thrush.
I give up. This one's the song thrush, Turdus musicus, in Middle English, and this is still rather a poetical word. And Scott James, the meaning of baldachin.
Well, I think it's a corruption of bald queen, or Queen Elizabeth with her wig off.
Horrible thought.
It's something to do with a tent or canopy.
Yes.
More seriously.
Yes, very much so. Where would you find it?
I'd normally expect to find it in outside an Italian palace.
Now look, 2 marks. Baldachin is a rather odd word because originally it was a woven stuff of a rich brocade with a woof of silk and a warp of gold. And then somehow or other it became an architectural feature, a canopy, which projects or stands on pillars over an altar or a throne or a doorway. And it's simply the Italian word for Baghdad, baldacco. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what does enuresis mean?
Esis is a disease, isn't it?
Well, this is very much so, yes.
You know, if the Halley Orchestra walks all over your toe, you have halitosis. Has it to do, my partner suggests, with the bodily function?
Yes. Very much so.
It means spending a sixpence.
Not a very accurate definition, but I'll give you your 2 marks. With babies and others, it normally just means bedwetting. Well, before we begin round two, I read out a quotation for each team to write down, and I hope the 2 women members of the teams will go on studying them, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "Where are the snows of yesteryear?" And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is, "The girl that I marry will have to be as soft and as pink as a nursery." And then in the last round, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. In the next round, we come to the author of the week. And I want the author identified and shall then ask some questions about the author and works. 2 marks for a correct answer. Here is a quotation for identification purposes. "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." To this power, who is the writer and which book does the quotation come from?
Well, it ought to be Jane Austen.
It is Jane Austen.
And I should think it's Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, well done.
Pride and Prejudice.
Yes. Absolutely right. Jane Austen, The Beginning of Pride and Prejudice. Dennis Norton, what was the name of the grand lady in Pride and Prejudice, and who are the two sisters with whose checkered path towards marriage the novel mainly deals?
The lady was Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
Yes.
And it deals with the Bennet family, Elizabeth and Jane.
Well done. 2 marks it is. Yes, in the end, Jane marries Charles Bingley and Elizabeth marries Fitzwilliam Darcy. But poor Lydia, the sister, runs off with an adventurer, but he's made to marry her too and amply provided for. Well done. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, who is the very clever and self-satisfied young lady who gives her name to the title of another of Jane Austen's novels, and whom does she marry in the end?
Well, I think it must be Emma.
Yes.
Oh, goodness. What's the name of her boyfriend? Can you remember?
Yeah, I got mixed up with Darcy, but that...
No, that was Pride and Prejudice. Yeah. Won't do.
No, her chum Harriet Smith tries to catch him as well, but I don't know if that helps.
No, I remember the whole story and the whole episode, but I'm not going to remember the name.
It isn't a very easy name. All right, one out of two. Emma takes in Harriet Smith as a kind of ward and then tries endlessly to get her married off. And Emma eventually does manage to marry a rich bachelor, who is Mr. Knightley.
Oh, how idiotic.
And Harriet catches Robert Martin, the farmer, on the second time round. One out of two. Thank you. Which was, perhaps, the earliest of Jane Austen's novels to be finished, but was published only posthumously, and which novel or novels did it set out to ridicule?
There were two published posthumously.
That's right.
One I can't remember. And the other was the Northanger Abbey.
That's right.
Northanger Abbey, I think she wrote really fairly early on, and in fact sold.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't published, and in fact the idiot publisher sold it back again.
That's right.
After she was famous. He didn't connect her with the work. Northanger Abbey was a send-up of the Monk Lewis, the Gothic.
That's fair enough. Well done. Thank you, Frank. 2 marks. Northanger Abbey was indeed begun in 1797, sold to a publisher in 1809. He sat on it till 1816, was then revised by Jane possibly, but seems to be the earliest of the works that she began on. And it was only published in 1818, the year after she died, as was Persuasion, which had been started very much later. And Northanger Abbey takes off the Gothic novel, as Frank quite rightly says, The Mistress of Udolpho and Monk Lewis and so on. Now around about the origin of various words and expressions, what I want to know is what they mean today and also how they originated. 2 marks and a possible bonus mark for exceptional learning. Dennis Power, what is a chancellor nowadays, but what was he originally?
Well, he can be the person who makes up the budget, Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Mm. Think of the Latin word it comes from.
I was trying to think of that. Mm. Without an H in it.
Yes.
Something to do with a council.
Cancellarius.
Cancellarius.
No, it's an anagram of Hank Cello.
Somebody who cancelled it out.
No, I don't think that's helping you at all. Nowadays, it's an officer of very great importance. Chancellor of the Exchequer, Chancellor of a Diocese, the Lord Chancellor. But it was originally a very, very small officer indeed, he called Cancellarius, who was stationed at the chancel in the Roman law courts as usher of the court, and he kept the public out. Oh. So he wasn't a very important chap at all, much more than. Now, Dennis Norden, why were dragoons so called?
I should think it's something to do with a dragon.
It is?
They either had a dragon as their sort of insignia, or else it was sort of symbolic of the way they breathed fire.
You're getting very close indeed, but not
and
necessarily
pounced upon maidens in forests.
Not necessarily they who actually breathed the fire. If you think of what they might have carried,
they carried some kind of gun, which
that's
was
right.
which was a expelled a lot of fire and smoke.
One half. They used to be armed with what were called dragons, which are short muskets which spouted out fire just like a real dragon. And the earliest of them, and Dennis got very close to this, had the head of a dragon wrought on the muzzle itself.
And just to point out to Jack the thing he said there, he said the gun started fire just like a real dragon.
I always believed implicitly in dragons. Now, Ian Scott James, what was the quadrivium and why so called? Q-U-A-D-R-I-V-I-U-M, quadrivium.
Well, I think it's pretty well safe to say it's something that was known in Roman times.
It was?
I should think it's some kind of a throne with four legs. is it a sort of stiff and solid object?
No.
Is it an association of objects?
Yes, that's right.
It's some kind of political
council of four.
Or council. Yes, of four.
Council of four, we think.
There are four things in it. That's absolutely right. But it is something to do with the way in which they used to teach in universities. I'm going about as far as I can.
Oh, the four R's. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and...
Rioting.
Right.
Well,
2 marks.
Half a mark for ingenuity.
Oh, dear.
It was the collective name given in the Middle Ages at the universities to the four liberal arts, arithmetic, music, geometry, and astronomy. And it's Latin for four-way, as opposed to the trivium, which was the three-way, which was grammar, rhetoric, and logic, which was the way you got to eloquence. Schenkmuir, tree, pole, pen.
Yes. Tree... Poe. Somebody writing up about a parrot up a tree.
No, I want to know where they are and what
well,
do they mean.
It's Cornish.
Yes.
And it's something about tree, pole, pen is you find a Cornish men because tree, they're all prefixes or suffixes
yes.
of Cornish names, aren't they? Like tree lawny, the
yes.
Settlers
mm-hmm.
Wells.
Yeah.
Pineapple pole and Pennsylvania 655. They're all.
Before you get off beam, I'm going to give you your 2 marks. They come in front of many Cornish names, whether personal names or place names: Trevose Head, Trevelyan, Polperro, Penzance, Penberthy, so on. And they mean the tree. It means a house in Cornish. The pole means a pool, and in the hilly bit of Cornwall, pen means a height or a peak. Well, now we come to the last round, and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Dillis Power, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Where are the snows of yesteryear?
The translation of a poem by François Villon. Où sont les neiges d'antan?
Well done. François Villon wrote the Great Testament, and he wrote about the beautiful dead lady, Isabella des Dames du Ton Jardin, and this was the one which contained the line translated into Where Are the Snows of Yesteryear? 2 marks. Now, Ian Scott James, the origin of your quotation, the girl that I marry will have to be as soft and as pink as a nursery.
Well, it was in one of those good, clean, wholesome American musicals, namely Annie Get Your Gun.
Well done. Remember who wrote the music and lyrics?
Berlin.
Yes. 2 marks. Music and lyrics by Irving Berlin. Put on at the Coliseum in 1947 and starred Dolores Gray and Bill Johnson. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever improbable story receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and to Where Are the Snows of Yesteryear.
If I may just read you with appropriate modesty a letter from my fan mail. Well, my fan mail, you see, for the past quarter. The letter goes, I met you during the war. You were the tall, youthful, fresh-faced, good-looking in an obvious sort of way. I saw you again last week, and look at you. You looked awful. Your hair's gone all grey, bags under your eyes, pale-faced, eyes like two lumps of rhubarb in a plate of semolina, teeth like a bag of wine gums. What's happened to you? Signed, a devoted fan. Well, devoted fan... I'll tell you exactly what's happened to me in the 30 years interval since we met. I haven't been getting enough sleep. For the last few years, what with one thing and another, I doubt whether I've averaged more than 2 or 3 hours a day. I've been getting my sleep at night, of course. The normal 14 hours, but... But, of course, that's not enough. You see, the whole of the world, or everybody in the world, are divided like late trains into sleepers and non-sleepers. And we sleepers, we just have to have more than non-sleepers. We, particularly those of us whom I call nappers, we have to have little naps all day. Now, a good napper can lie down anywhere and sleep. Hamlet. Do you know, are you familiar with Hamlet? Neither am I. But, Hamlet is totally absorbed with the question of not getting enough sleep, even where the play of Hamlet takes place. The castle was named after a Spanish word for the noise made when a person sleeps. El snore. If you look at Hamlet desperately trying to get back to sleep, you see, in the early days in Denmark, they had a kind of sleeping pill, which wasn't a pill. It was an ointment. It was rancid Danish butter mixed with herbs, which they rubbed into their skin. And when Hamlet couldn't get to sleep in one of those tortuous monologues of his, do you remember the one he says? He says, to sleep, perchance to dream. Ah, there's the rub. He found it. There's a lot about sleep in Hamlet, there really is. And it's, and also, you see, in the general world, this business of dozing off, having a cat nap, having a ziz, it's talked about in song. And if you see Bless the Bride, the A.P. Herbert Vivian Ellis musical, when the young French bridegroom sings to his bride his idea of a lovely day, which is to have a ziz. He sings, "This is my lovely day. This is the day I will remember." He sang rather higher than I do. A good napper, a good zizzer like myself, you've got to snatch the opportunity where you can.
But not in the modern world. It's all gone.
You can't have a quick nap in a telephone box. They're doing away with the telephone boxes. You have to telephone in a public building. You have to crouch beneath a sort of plastic hairdryer with shotgun wounds in it. A taxi, a 3-minute trip in a taxi now costs about 45 bob. The sound of the meter ticking over is like machine gun fire. You can't possibly sleep. So I went upstairs, away from the sound, into the bedroom. But then jet planes, you see, live near London Airport. Jumbo jet. Wheels, all 42 of them, 9 inches from the BBC Two aerial. You can't sleep. Eventually, put earplugs in, absolute silence, in comes the Afghan hound. Sees me lying back there, levitates herself as they can, you know, they're oriental dogs, proceeded forward and dropped on me. I was bent double at 90 degrees for a fortnight. Nowadays, in the modern world, you cannot do this thing of having these little refreshing zizzes, naps and snoozes. And that, my fan, is why I'm not looking as healthy and well as I looked 30 years ago. I just am not getting the sleep. Or as François Villon said, where are the snoozers of yesteryear?
We go on to Dennis Norton with his rather more complicated storyline. The girl that I marry will have to be as soft and as pink as a nursery.
Tell you a thing I've never been able to understand about technology. If they can repair a communication satellite while it's 8,000 miles up in space, why does my TV set always have to go back to the shop? Not only go back, but cost me money to be taken back. My TV repairman has a small, clapped-out green van. But you should see the amount that he charges on the bill for time and labour removing and returning set. You'd think it'd been carried round the borders of the parish on the shoulders of 8 cardinals. One thing, the only thing, that I've learnt from this shrewd craftsman is the real reason why so many people say television is educational. I have personally, with just one 17-inch set, sent 3 of his sons through boarding school. To say nothing of that daughter of his and her so-called modelling course. Now, if I seem to be hot under the collar about this practitioner of cathode tube larceny or diddler on the roof, as we called him when he charged 6 man-hours for turning the aerial round, it's because he is only one of the many so-called experts who are drawing the financial life blood out of every non-technical minded householder. The electric toaster's bust, I was told the other morning. Do without it. I said, well, do without it. Try ironing the bread. No, she said, no. She said, you've got to have it repaired. I've had a slice of bread in there 10 minutes, and it's as white as anything. It doesn't matter. What does it matter? She said, it's brown bread. So I took the toaster into the electrician's, dropping it on the counter. I addressed him by that affectionate little nickname which he likes us to call him. Sir. Sir, I said, this is my first repair, so please be kind. Kind. When I took a look at the bill for one electric toaster, the spit dried in my mouth. You see, what I'm getting towards is this. There used to be a rather jocular saying that the ideal wife for any man is a deaf and dumb nymphomaniac who lives over a pub. Well, now, that ideal, unfortunately, no longer applies. Not in the light of modern servicing charges. The best wife a man can have today is one whom he can use as a sort of live-in repairman. Preferably, one with her own television set, the degree of Bachelor of Engineering Science, and a certificate from the Royal Society of Electronics. Or as Irving Berlin rather neatly put it, the girl that I marry will have TV, a BSc Eng, and an RSE.
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, and he and his partner, Anne Scott James, also win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, who also compiled the questions. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.